Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm your host, Jack Vow, on faculty at the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my colleague and friend, the director for the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Jack. Thank you very much. I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
I am somewhat exhausted, but it's a very busy time.
You're in the midst of a semester with classes that you're teaching and
working outside of class.
And then working outside of class. Teaching
here.
That's
a thing.
You're teaching Augustine today, in fact. I'll make a little plug for you. They're excited to hear you teach about the confessions.
Poor Augustine.
Poor Augustine.
I'll try to do him service.
Oh, I know you will. You have in the past. So that'll be a great class today. I'm looking forward to that myself. We had an interesting conversation Sunday night at dinner. Maybe you'll remember.
Don't we always?
We always do, yeah. Fascinating questions people bring up at Sunday dinners. And I was about to say, let me give you a plug for Sunday dinners. We have, I guess back in 2009 or so, we started holding an open dinner, basically, on Sunday nights. And Day would cook, and we'd all sit around the table, and whoever came could offer whatever question he had to offer, and the conversation would ensue from there. Anything was open to for debate, for discussion. We've had people who were not believers come and ask very good questions. We've had lots of Christians ask good questions. We've had debates at the table between people on various subjects that you would think would people would have to lob hand grenades nowadays at each other to discuss, but we've seemed to be able to do it without any deaths or dismemberment.
Yeah, anything from the cake baking stuff for homosexual weddings to are dolphins non-human persons?
That's right. That's right. That's right. There was a law that the Indian Parliament was trying to pass about creating a characterization called non-human persons. We've talked about beauty, we've talked about politics, we've talked about theological differences, we've talked about how to live as a Christian in the midst of this world. And in that last category comes the question that was asked for us Sunday night. Mm-hmm. One of the fellows asked, he said kind of like this: I have an intuition that people shouldn't be screaming at each other in public over political differences.
Uh-huh.
I'm having trouble defending it. How is it just an intuition of mine, or is it really not a good idea that people shout at each other over political differences? And what would be the Christian sort of foundation for an answer to a question like that? We had a great conversation about it, I thought.
So like the context of this, culturally, for people who are listening to this 100 years from now, archiving thought in the early 21st century, our political world has been very, very divisive and, shall we say, demonizing on both sides. For decades, easily, at least since the Cultural Revolutions, but maybe even before that, but definitely since then. And it kind of gets heavier and heavier as the decades go by. And then with a certain election in 2016, it just seemed to kind of come to a point and somebody, kicked the stone over and all the bugs and worms started scattering all over the place. And it's been an ugly time.
It sure has. And it's on both sides. I've certainly heard a lot of leftists screaming at conservatives like Ted Cruz in a restaurant. But I heard one yesterday where this horrible man was screaming epithets that I can't repeat here at Nancy Pelosi, who's the Democratic head of the... So it does happen on both sides, it seems. The only difference I've seen is that the people on the right seem to be condemning it, and some people on the left are saying that's exactly what we ought to do. We've heard from the extremes in the Democratic Party saying, go out and find them and yell at them and make them uncomfortable and all that stuff. So it's almost as though clearly those few are advocating this kind of way of thinking.
Yeah, and it seems that the context at the moment is this sort of increased incensed nature of our political discourse.
Yeah, exactly.
It just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. People screaming at politicians in restaurants, at their homes, making absolute scenes of themselves and stuff like that in various ways, both absurd and terrifying.
It is sort of terrifying. Imagine being yelled at in public about your political views.
By strangers.
By strangers who are chanting and screaming and you know, it's very intimidating and unnerving. Remind me, if this isn't the case, isn't there such a thing as a statute on the books called disturbing the peace?
Yeah.
I thought there was such a thing. I thought somebody could come up and stand in your front yard and yell at you. And you could call the police and say, this man is disturbing the peace. Can you cart him off?
Yeah, it seems that if you're yelling at politicians, people want to argue that this is their right to protest.
That's sort of a free speech thing.
Right. And then when it's not yelling at politicians, it still wants to be connected to a free speech thing. It's our right to protest. We're not screaming at people anyway. We're screaming at a system.
Aha.
That people are, at this moment, may be representing, but we're protesting that. So there's some kind of entanglement with like protest and speech. If somebody was just standing on your lawn and screaming at you that you're a dirty so-and-so because they got mad at you at work because you did something.
What? Your leaves blew over into their yard.
Yeah, or something like that. Then, yeah, someone had a case for disturbing the peace. But somebody is screaming at you while holding a sign saying, you know, your healthcare policy is destroying millions of lives,
right?
Then it becomes political speech and political protests, and then people, it seems authority figures get a little bit cautious about trying to shut that down, because they're like, where's the line between free speech and right to protest and disturbing the peace and harassment?
Right.
And the more violent or incensed or outraged or 11th hour our political discourse is going to get, I think the more and more that issue is going to come to a point. Exactly when do we look at the screaming, yelling, and say, and the harassment, and even necessarily the violence, like, this is enough. Mm-hmm. And part of the moral conundrum is not just that. It's not just, you know, freedom of speech and freedom of protest, but also the guy who brought up the question, this was in, it was raised because of a friend of his who was a Marxist,
right,
who was like protesting this way. And he felt it wasn't a good idea to do this for whatever reasons. And his friend's response was something along the lines of, but they're killing people.
Uh-huh. Right? That kind of goes along with your argument there, that this is a political argument, and the results of the policy is damaging people.
Yeah,
so I have a right to sort of scream at you.
Yeah, I've argued this elsewhere. I actually wrote about it once. That try and think of it this way: if think about the person who, you know, is an Antifa member who like swings in a bike lock to crack somebody's head, or like the whoever, you know, who shoots up an abortion clinic because, you know, for those reasons.
Sure.
If we look at that and we are aghast, and yet at the same time, if you seriously thought that millions of innocent people are dying because of that person over there and those persons over there, wouldn't you feel some sort of impetus to raise a ruckus on some level? Mm-hmm. Like, would it not be like almost a feeling of a moral imperative that you're supposed to, like, how if millions of people or hundreds of people or even a couple of people are literally being killed by certain individuals, and then how can you not say something or do something or raise Cain or whatever like that? Mm-hmm. So there's this moral thing in it as well. There's the political issue of like freedom of speech and freedom of protest, but then there's the moral issue of, if you really thought millions of people are dying, then wouldn't you raise a ruckus? Wouldn't you fight? Wouldn't you take up arms against the thing? And because of that, the argument is difficult.
Yeah.
The argument is like, well, why shouldn't you scream at people if you think they're killing millions and millions of people? Well, one argument would be to tell them they're not killing millions and millions of people, but I think that's where that's where it becomes quagmire-ish, because the people have been so convinced on both sides. There's been narratives on both sides that basically posit the other side as this giant behemoth thing. Mm-hmm. This thing that is destroying everything, and this is the 11th hour, and we have to stop it. And fighting that narrative, for some reason, extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. It's extremely difficult. It's probably the same reason why it's difficult to argue against like somebody who gets radicalized into a terrorist group, whether it's Islamic or something else. You know, they get convinced of, hey, you know, it's not just your boring everyday life with your boring everyday human issues. There's actually an enemy to fight, and right. there's a way to fight them, and there's a way to do something meaningful and strike a blow for justice and goodness and right. There's a way to be a superhero, man.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah.
that kind of attitude is
very attractive.
It's very attractive. It's very powerful.
Sure, I can see why. I think the, you know, if you had a man next door to your house drowning a child in his swimming pool or something, and you didn't raise a ruckus about it, then, you know, you would be guilty of sin, I think. Mm-hmm. You have to do something. I can see why that's a compelling argument. Of course, it's a bit of a leap, isn't it, to think that a particular political position will, by its very existence or non-existence, do this horrible damage. If you see a man next door to you and he's holding his child's head underwater, then you know there's a life at stake there. There's no doubt about it, right? Mm-hmm. But when you start saying, well, if you don't pass this XYZ law, then millions of people are going to die, or right. hundreds of people are going to die.
Right. Or if you confirm this Supreme Court justice, then you're basically saying all women shouldn't be believed or something like that.
Exactly.
You're endangering a bunch of, you know, women who are going to be sexually assaulted or something like that.
It is a bit of a leap. They have to leap over that logical chasm, I think, to get there. And the problem I've found, and this is just now because of my excursions into the peace-loving world of Facebook, I've heard people say when I question that chasm, when I say you've leapt to a conclusion here, their argument is you are reasoning about something that is only an emotional issue, and you need to stop reasoning. That's reasoning ability that you have is a sort of privilege, and you need to put that aside and take seriously the emotional strain and stress that people are going through having dealt with this thing. Well, that too, I think, is a bit of a leap in the sense that, I mean, I understand how you have to have compassion for people who've gone through trauma, but to think that this particular issue, if goes the way they want, will solve that trauma, that I think that's a leap to a conclusion too. So the fact that I'm trying to establish whether or not this particular issue is going to lead to that terrible outcome is not a lack of compassion for the people who've gone through that outcome. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to be able to get that across to people, but it sort of falls on deaf ears in the middle of the,
right. I mean,
the heat of the battle.
I feel like Dr. Beisner brought this up once, that you know, he was talking about if someone's been told over and over again that something bad is going to happen to them because of some sort of invisible problem. Mm-hmm. And it really, really makes them afraid and scared, and they get worried. If you come along and say, well, wait a minute, that thing you think is there is not there, you're not worried, why would you look at that person and say, you're not being compassionate? You know, you need to understand their feelings. Like, I do understand their feelings. That's why I'm trying to tell them that the problem actually isn't there, so they won't be scared anymore.
Yeah, right.
It's like, if somebody is feeling bad over a lie,
right.
then the most compassionate thing you could do for their feelings is to expose the lie.
Exactly.
Right? It's like, and for some reason, people, I don't know, I won't say they just don't get that. It's that they don't think the lie is a lie.
Right.
Right? They want to argue that, no, there is this massive thing. I was going to say earlier that I think it's the problem of thinking of evil and stuff in systemic terms.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is such a thing, I believe, there is such a thing as systemic evil in some way, that evil and sin can be, you know, entrenched into a societal norms, culture, law. It could just be there. It could be entrenched. But the problem is that when I think of systemic, I'm thinking of specific laws and norms.
Right.
Right. I'm thinking of very specific practices and norms, and you can actually see them. I think when systemic gets used by most people who use that term, it is this, as usual, nebulous,
right.
indeterminate, ill-defined thing that just makes it sound like we're fighting the Priory of Zion or the Illuminati or the Syndicate from X-Files.
Right, something like that. It's amorphous. There's no place to put your ire.
There's no place to put your ire.
Everywhere and nowhere.
Right, there's no place to put your ire except everywhere.
Except everywhere.
Right, so it's like there's no way to actually fight the thing. Or there's no way. It's like, I don't know how to put this. The thing that came to my brain is like patriarchy is not falsifiable. You understand what I mean? There's no way to prove it or disprove it. Okay. Because by the very terms that get laid out about patriarchy or heteronormativity or, xenophobia or the way they all get described, if you talk about patriarchy as specific sexism of these specific practices between this man and this woman, that's something. But if you talk about patriarchy in this nebulous conspiratorial term of like the systemic thing that's just there and it's always been there and it's everywhere, but you can't see it unless you've read the books I read, it's like I said, it's like fighting the Priory of Zion or like fighting the Syndicate from the X-Files. It's like, how the heck do you fight that? And of course, it would create a conspiratorial paranoid mindset that sees the thing everywhere. And since you see it everywhere, and you see it, then of course trying to convince you that it's not there. It reminds me of in Chesterton's Chesterton.
Chesterton. Yeah. Wait a minute. I've read some Chesterton. He made cigarettes.
Gabriel Kelvin Chesterton.
Gabriel. I didn't know his first name.
He was a good man.
Chesterfield. Chesterfield cigarettes.
Sorry.
So I guess I don't know this Chesterton fellow.
Orville Redenbacher Chesterton. In his book Orthodoxy, he has the chapter about the madman.
Oh, yeah.
Where he basically, he does an interesting, I've taught this to the students before, that in the beginning of Orthodoxy, he has those two chapters, the madman and the suicide of thought.
Right.
And it's an interesting pairing because the madman attacks rationalism and the suicide of thought attacks skepticism. Mm. And the way it looks to most people when they first read it is that the madman is attacking reason. But then the suicide of thought is like ardently defending reason. Like if you think about it in those terms, it looks like a contradiction, but it's not. He's defending real reason in its right place against a rationalism and a skepticism.
Excellent. Good distinction.
And in The Madman, he says that rationalism, which he defines as reason in the void, it's reason that has no other groundings. It doesn't have common sense. It doesn't have imagination. It doesn't have faith. It doesn't have intuition. It doesn't have thousands of years of tradition built up of human experience.
Exactly.
It has nothing except just pure, cold, logical analysis of things.
Yeah.
And the belief that somehow it can transcend things and get a purely objective view.
Right.
That way only leads to a kind of insanity where the world becomes fully explainable in extremely narrow terms.
Mm-hmm.
That the rationalist in the end is no different than a guy who thinks he's a chicken. Right, and he has a perfect explanation for everything that everyone deals with him. Everybody deals with him. It's exactly how a chicken would act, and exactly how a chicken would do. And you're like, but a chicken can't do X. No, a chicken can't do X. And then, well, look, you can do X. Why? My gosh, chickens can do X. I guess it's like everything falls into that little tight little chamber and finds its place, and it's a very cramped, narrow view of everything.
And if you try to convince me I wasn't a chicken, that's how you'd treat a chicken.
Yeah, that's just more proof. That's exactly how you would treat a chicken.
Sure.
There's a whole page where he has, like, you know, people do all kinds of ordinary, mundane, monotonous things that mean nothing. In one sense, you know, they whistle while they're walking, or they click their heels, or they take a swipe at some grass with their cane while they're walking down the street. Which I have a feeling these were things Chesterton probably did.
Sounds like Chesterton.
Yeah, it sounds like things he would do. He said these are just normal, just meaningless things that like humans do. You know, just whatever. But the madman, the rationalist, the hyper rationalist who just has everything fit into their perfectly logically worked out little clockwork box, would see all that stuff and read way too much significance into it. Mm-hmm. Like the whistle is signaling to an accomplice, and the swishing of the grass is an attack on private property. I remember when I read that, he put it in his like fun, jovial kind of way, and at the same time, it sounds like people who look at things and want to read an enormous amount of systemic issue into one action.
Yes.
If you go here or you do this or you read this or you even question such and such, then you're part of this massive thing. It just sounds like that same kind of insanity.
Right.
There's this worldview that is extremely exhaustive, but extremely cramped.
Yeah.
And small. When you're stuck in it, you're stuck in a rut, and there's no way to get out of it, because even your attempts to get them out of it is just proof of the thing that they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, it's proof.
Yeah.
You know, there is, you know, maybe it's not what you think it, you know, maybe this whole, you know, patriarchal heteronormative thing is not quite what you thought. That's exactly what someone in the patriarchy would say, you know, like something like that.
The invisible cat argument.
Yeah, the invisible cat argument. You know, you right. see, is there? There's a cat in that chair. It's invisible. Well, I can't see it exactly.
Yes,
you know, it's
exactly.
like you can't. There's that's what I mean by
proof.
That's what I mean by this. There's a certain kind of view of systemic problems, you know, that usually gets defined in terms of patriarchy, heteronormativity, and all the usual boogeymen.
Yeah. Yeah.
That just is sound is just non-falsifiable, and because it's non-falsifiable, it feels just like a complete conspiracy theory,
mm-hmm.
and it feels like what the heck are you supposed to do with it other than just shout and scream at everybody with yeah. whom you disagree with? Because if they disagree with you, it's not that they have another opinion; it's that they're a sheep of the system.
Yeah, and they're part of this evil. That's right, part of the evil system. So that's the issue of trying to learn to make. To bridge that gap without being called a name, because
yeah.
that's what happens, right? You say, well, hang on a second. I'm not sure your conclusion actually follows from the premises. And they say, you're just a sheep in the system, right? You're part right. of the evil deal.
How dare you use logic?
Yeah, well, and that's what it's come to. It's not just, yeah, I can't answer your logic, but I'm still right. They're saying, how dare you use logic? Logic is just a privilege to an educated few, probably white men.
Right.
That's
what I mean by
which is insane.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. Yeah, by the insanity that everything that gets in your way is only false. It doesn't matter what it is. Even the very branch you're standing on. You
right.
know, like this, right. these the shouting, screaming, outrage crowd on both sides heavily relies on the notion of free speech. Right?
Yeah, right.
But if free speech gets in their way, well, then they'll gladly try to shut it down. Right?
They don't seem to stop to tell you to shut up, though.
Yeah, no.
Exactly. They're all for free speech as long as it pertains to them personally.
Right. So it's like free speech is this glorious, beautiful act of resistance unless certain individual disagrees with me, then suddenly it's just a tool of white, straight men.
Uh-huh.
And it always
uh-huh.
was a tool of white,
straight
really
men. And we really should limit it.
And we really should limit
yeah, that's,
it, shouldn't we?
That's a whole issue all by itself.
That's the madness.
Yeah.
I have this cramped worldview that everything that falls into it suddenly becomes part of that worldview. And there's no room for maybe it's the world's a bit more complicated than you're making it
right.
out to be.
Well, and that kind of leads me to my point. I was thinking, as we were talking, that's essential that we figure out what to do about that logical bridge and where logic stays and how much we can rely on it and so on. And without giving up, we don't want to be uncompassionate, lacking in compassion, obviously. But there's another aspect to the problem, and that came, I think, in the very question that he asked, because as you said, he was talking about a friend of his who is a Marxist, materialist Marxist, and was arguing that this is a fair thing to do because of the fact that the issue is so severe. It's going to end in the death of people and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So yelling and screaming at somebody may be actually a good and right and noble and so on thing. But what he was saying is not just is it wrong to yell at people, but what is the foundation for an argument against it? You know, how mm-hmm. would we craft As Christians, because we were all believers there, we were all discussing this as in-house, sort of. How as Christians do we support this notion that it's wrong to do that?
Right.
And then we started bringing up questions that were more theological in essence. You started, I know, with a right statement that we're all made in the image of God, that human beings deserve a certain dignity because of the fact that we are made in the image of God, regardless of our positions, regardless
right.
of our economic status or our sexual nature or gender, whatever, our political affiliations, any of those things don't make any yeah. difference at all when it comes to actually showing dignity. And so maybe shouting at somebody is showing a lack of dignity.
There's also an element of localism that needs to come in. Like mm-hmm. it's one thing to shout at a stranger who you just sort of make an avatar for something. It's another thing when it's your actual neighbor who you know and who knows you
right.
and you know what's going on. And thus, if you have to shout at them, there's probably going to be actual cause and actual way to get mad at them that makes sense.
Right.
You know, this was again Chesterton. Like that was the quote I did that brought up the Imago Dei, I think, because these two things are connected. It's easier to treat it all. All persons should be treated in the Imago Dei because they're all in the Imago Dei. It's easier to treat someone in the image of God when they're near, when they're like your actual neighbor, your actual like coworker, someone you're actually in community with in some way.
Which is really an argument for local government at its best, right?
Right. It's like instead of everybody trying to take over the top, they like help their own community.
Right.
You know, we all the communities help themselves and so on and so forth. It's a federalist distributist argument. We can't go into it. The point is that it was another Chesterton quote about how politicians ought to be local enough to kick them.
Yes.
Kind of idea. And I think most people want to focus, I think even on Sunday night, most people wanted to focus on the kicking part. Right?
Right.
Like, but should we kick our politics? And I'm like, I'm not sure. I mean, Chesterton was being very, you know, Chestertonian in his flair. But I don't think the point of that sentence was the kicking part. I think it was the local part.
Right, exactly. He has to be in geographically close enough location to be able to kick him. Not so much, I want to kick him.
Right, which implies
justifying violence.
Which implies it's someone who is maybe a neighbor, who implies someone you know. Which means if you kick them, you may actually have good reason, and maybe they'll actually respond to it in a way other than just, you know, whatever. Like, there's a chance. Treating it local with people you actually know changes your way you deal with them because it changes the relationship you have with them.
That's right. That's right. And when you actually have – this is one of the problems, as we've talked in the past, about social media, that you don't actually have that kind of local connection to the people you're talking to. You may know them vaguely, but in general, you're talking to an anonymous mass, right? And so it's easier for you to say and do things, say things anyway, that would be maybe prudently resisted when you're in person, right?
Right.
When there's a possibility of the other guy actually looking you in the eye and calling you wrong, that way, somebody you know and so on, then so there really is a lot to be said for individuals confronting other individuals. You know, there's the whole Matthew 18 idea about if you've got something against your brother, go to him directly. Don't go on social media, in other words, and spread the word that you're really mad at your brother. Go to him, right, and speak to him. And most of the time, you guys can work it out directly with each other.
And notice, even in the wording of that, it points to the thing about relationship. It said if your brother has aught against you,
right?
So there's this idea of, like, go directly to the person, and the person is someone you can go directly to.
Yeah.
Because they're in community with them. This is like the problem with social media is also the problem with this certain views of like systemic issues to the way we, you know, view our politics as being like all at the top and, you know, who cares what goes on locally, is everything becomes very disembodied.
Yes.
And gaseous and, you know, and amorphous and nebulous, and the evil is everywhere. So we must attack everything, and yet social media is really talking to no one because it's talking to everyone. So it's like the evil is everywhere, therefore it's no one, so it's everyone. Mm-hmm. And in social media, I'm talking to everyone, which is almost like talking to no one because who can hold me accountable, and I don't care what anyone else thinks.
Right.
It's this disembodying of things. And like,
well, the disembodiment actually makes it possible for you to take the lid off of your anger and let it flow at a far higher in temperature, as it were, than if it were one-on-one like that.
Imprudently.
It's so easy to do that. Wouldn't it be wise for us to focus? It's not that there aren't things out there to be indignant about, right? We both agree that there are certainly wrongs being done by individuals and even groups, perhaps. But to focus your attention on the actual problem, where the source of the problem is, would be far more efficient and far more, I would think, more satisfying, frankly, than to just be sort of mad at the amorphous, gaseous world.
Right. Well, that's the thing. If you think the problem is in that amorphous, gaseous thing, then that's what you're going to yell at, right?
Exactly, right. But then how satisfied can you be that there's any kind of...
Not, I mean, unless you, like, you know, actually draw blood. But even then, it's like, well, that one person got cracked over the skull, but the whole system remains
something
like that. Yeah, I mean, the issue of, like, there are things to be indignant about, I feel like the issue is not... It's like there's an intuition that screaming in somebody's face is not good. All right, there's the Majordei thing. There's the sense of like they're a stranger. There also was a practicality thing we brought up, that is that really going to change things?
Right.
You know, somebody,
right.
There was that. But I noticed during the course of the conversation that it didn't seem like, it's not just that we have an intuition about confronting or even being indignant. It's like screaming at people specifically. The reason I saw that is because another guy brought up, well, what about Jesus? Like, didn't he make the cords?
Yes.
And the whip braided cord thing and went into the temple and drove out the money changers?
Yes, he certainly did.
Which, I mean, I remember a friend of mine who, like, he's a teacher, but he's also a craftsman who, like, has a wood shop. And, you know, I once came up to his house once. He was in the backyard gutting a boar or pig that he shot in his backyard. And he was like, I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm, getting out the ribs and the bacon and I'm going to give it to a neighbor of mine. And I'm like, yeah, he basically was Ron Swanson, only a little bit more sociable. He said, think about that. He said that Jesus made a flail of cords. He made it. He said, you realize what he did? He said he would have had to, like, gotten all the rope and everything and then sat down for at least an hour just braiding that thing together the whole time knowing exactly what he was going to do with it. This wasn't like a random flash in the pan bit of anger.
Right.
This was like a calculated, deliberate, probably stewing over it.
Mm-hmm.
Thing, and he did something that is technically speaking very violent. I mean, not technically speaking, literally speaking, very violent. Whipped people and flipped over their tables and probably shouted about it, right?
Probably did.
So the people will say, look, there is precedent. There is Jesus precedent,
mm-hmm.
which is the best
mm-hmm.
kind of precedent, to act indignant and even act violently when you see something wrong.
Right.
And so the question is, is our intuition about the shouting thing, is it against aggressive confrontation, period, or is it just against the shouting of strangers? Because there seems to be, they would argue, Jesus gives room for some kind of aggressive action in some context, some specific way. Or is it, are we looking at that wrong? Is what Jesus did like a sui generis kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One off, for those of you who don't read.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, I let my pretentious flag fly. I apologize.
Right. Well, that is a concern. He certainly didn't seem to mind being a man of action when mm-hmm. the time came. I do think that there's a distinction, and I brought this up on Sunday night. I think there's a distinction, first, about between the political sphere and the indignity that the money changers were showing to God. So, I mean, I remember the fellow you're talking about bringing that up. Said something about, wouldn't it be good to make a whip and go into Congress and just, you know, run them all out of Congress? But for the analogy to work, the Capitol building has to be the house of God, and it's not.
Right.
And I think that exemplifies the point I was trying to make the other night, which is, actually, a point that we've made, I've made on podcasts with you, that we have allowed the political aspect of our lives to become so all-inclusive, all-encompassing, that there really isn't any realm outside of the political in our mindset.
Right.
And so it's easy to equate the house of God with the Capitol building. You see? That's how that happens, I think, in people's minds, because they assume that the greatest things of our day are happening at that level.
Right.
And I want to argue, I think the greatest things are not happening at the legal level, at the level of politics. Politics is the smallest level in life, it seems to me. There are far bigger things. Family in general and the procreation of and raising of children is infinitely more important than what laws we have and what taxes we pay. But that's still of this world. There's a much larger sphere even than that, and that is the love of God and the devotion to the one who made us and the sanctification of our souls and to live in eternity. That is infinitely larger than the sort of political sphere. Now, we want the political sphere. Don't get me wrong about this. I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying that it needs, there are much larger spheres, and we want the political sphere to somehow reflect our beliefs about the other things, you see, and what's good about the other things.
We want it to be in right relation with
the exactly. And so when we wonderfully have the opportunity to vote, to elect representatives, to send to Congress, to actually make laws for our country. But to think that the laws that they're making for the country somehow are now going to be the moral fabric of our lives or something is absurd.
Yeah.
And it has to be the other way around. It's that we send people to Congress who have moral fabric and understand this bigger picture and then can put the political aspect in its right order, you see. That's how it seems to me. But what if you're a materialist, like the person that was the friend of our young man on Sunday night, saying basically as a Marxist, whether she admits it or not, the material world is all there is, and so the distribution of material is all that matters. Mm-hmm. Literally all that matters. That's a joke. If that's the case in her mind, then how can you get around the idea that the legal system that decides these things is the most important thing in the universe?
I mean, there's an argument to be made that there's a growing disharmony in our society. We were, prided on being a melting pot. Whether that melting pot was really that successful or not is neither here nor there. The point is that there's this idea that America could be this place where people of disparate backgrounds and cultures and even like native languages could all come together and be one people, right? They could do that. And if there is disharmony now, amongst people, our growing disharmony, this kind of fracturing, fragmenting tribalism that people say is growing. Exactly how thick it's growing, I'm not sure, but people are worried about it. If there's disharmony there, then it's possibly that our instinct would be that if there's disharmony here, then there's got to be disharmony further back somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And putting the political sphere on top or at the center is a disharmony because politics is not supposed to be the center of things. It's not supposed to be the center of things. It's supposed to matter and be important, but it has its own place and it's not the center. And when you put it at the center, I don't know, I want to think of like a musical analogy. Like it's like, I don't know, it's like trying to be in a key and be atonal at the same time. Mm-hmm. So like you put, it's like I'm going to play in the key of F, and every single key you put there is not the key of F. Like, that's not your center anymore. Or you're like, I want to play this really happy song, and you do it in minor key or something like that. I feel like I'm butchering it.
That's okay. I feel
like you're looking into my soul with daggers.
Nonsense.
This is what happens when you
I'll just cut all that nonsense out.
That's what happens when you talk music next to a conductor. But it's something like, if there's a disharmony somewhere, that there must be on like the social or political level, then there must be a deeper disharmony that's actually causing it.
Yeah, I see exactly what you're talking
about. And it's not just, and if you're, again, a materialist, the disharmony must be the, unequal distribution of material goods. But if you're not a materialist, then there's some sort of disharmony of thought, of belief, of mind, of soul, that there's something we put in the wrong place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's a kind of idolatry then, isn't it? Mm-hmm. If the wrong thing is at the center, then if God's not at the center, then whatever is at the center becomes an idol.
Yeah.
And idolatry, by necessity, warps everybody's sensibilities about everything else. And idolatry makes you see the rest of the world through the idol. Have you ever seen, I'm trying to remember what they call these things. Have you ever seen, it's like I can't think of the word. Say, a decoration that's hung from the ceiling and it has a string and the string is connected to, say bits of paper that are cut this way,
Yeah.
And around. And if you hang it from the ceiling, it all hangs beautifully, like a sort of, like a big, what would you call it? It's not a lampshade, it's not a collage, it's a kind of sculpture that is flexible. If you were to take it down from the ceiling and lay it on the table, it all collapses down flat, right? I feel like our society is like that. We have all these pieces and they're all connected to each other. But if you disconnect them from the ceiling so that gravity can't pull them apart and make them relate to each other in their proper place, then they all sort of collapse on top of each other. And it's like that. It seems to me that the largest bottom part of it is politics. and all the other pieces are actually higher than it. They may be smaller and in different shapes and so on. But if you take it off of the ceiling and lay it down on the table, the only thing you see is the political sphere. It's like that. I'm trying to make an analogy. It's not working.
Right. I think
something like that.
Think of like in terms of an arch. You know, the keystone is like necessarily might not even be the biggest stone. It might be the smallest stone out of the arch.
Right.
But it's the thing that's actually ultimately holding it together.
That's right.
You know, I mean, if you move the keystone, everything collapses except maybe the bottom stones, like the grounding stones.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
So the political is like where things touch the earth most directly. You know, that's important.
That's a good way to look at it.
But if you don't have all those other stones over top of it, and if you certainly don't have the keystone, then you don't have an arch anymore. It all falls apart. And human existence, human life is very much like as an arch. You know, it's like an arch. With apologies to all my Marxist friends, but I don't care. There is a hierarchy of...
Well, that's where that word arch comes from.
There's a hierarchy.
Hierarchy.
Yeah, there's a hierarchy of goods, not just material goods. There's a hierarchy of goods, and you have to have the right good at the top and center of that hierarchy, or everything else is going to fall apart. It's going to be disharmonious. It's just going to have a ripple effect that just cascades across everything else and causes everything to warp out of place. Even the smallest, you know, deviation from it could cause like catastrophic consequences.
That's right. It won't hold the weight of the system up anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm thinking about gravity pulling down something to show, and you're talking about fighting against gravity and creating an arch that goes above our heads. In both cases, we're using the reality of gravity to make something happen. Mm-hmm. And the arch is sustained because of that keystone. Right. The arch can stand against gravity. Right. My collage or whatever it is collapses when it's no longer able to be stretched by gravity. You know, gravity is pulling the pieces apart so that you can see them all relate to each other. And it's beautiful. An arch is a beautiful thing. Good analogies both. But I think what I like about your analogy is that the stones that remain are the ones that are most connected to the ground. And I think that's a good way to look at politics. Politics is sort of where the rubber meets the road in day-to-day life, right? But without the kind of inspiration that a larger vision, a larger worldview gives, you can't know how to build that arch. You can't know how to build that collage or whatever. You can't figure out how the pieces are supposed to fit together.
Right. I feel like it's arguable. Now we may be getting into a completely another field, but let's see what happens. It's arguable that, I mean, things don't happen for no reason. Let me put it that way. Something causes something to happen. I'm being very Aristotelian here for all my bad grammar. All right. It's like, it doesn't just, you know, only God has like the motive principle within himself. There's like everything else is like moving to something else. And I mean, it's arguable because this is like me semi steel manning the other side in a way.
Uh-huh. Good.
Is that not the shouters and the screamers, but the people who like want to get stuff done. If they're an argument I have heard of, or a variation of it, I'm putting it in my own words, is that there's kind of been a dearth of ethical thinking in life. This kind of is like, as I said, the semi steel manning of the person who like you try to explain something like, but you're not taking care of the feelings. Yeah. A better version of that is, it's, you know, there's a crisis and you're not you, but like just a general you, there's a crisis and you're being all heady and abstract.
Yes, that's what the argument I think
right
that's
they're being all heady
that's
and
what
abstract
they think I'm
doing. When what we need is something that gets done,
right?
And so it's like, so there's like two errors that could be committed. One is you get rid of the keystone and everything collapses and you just have the stones touching the earth. But the other one is you take the keystone, that's all you keep. And in both of those situations, you don't have an arch,
right?
You don't have it. So there's this connectivity of things. Your metaphysics is supposed to cash out in ethics, which is supposed to cash out in politics. That also is Aristotle, because he saw those things as connected, almost in a circular fashion. I mean, his politics came out, literally comes out of his ethics, because his book on ethics ends him saying, all right, let's get to politics. Right. And his ethics bleeds right out of his metaphysics, which is, you know, like everything is aimed towards some good. But his metaphysics comes out of his physics. because he observed the world. And he said, well, how does the world work? He's like, whatever the metaphysical reality to be has to cash out somehow in the real world. Mm-hmm. And, God is in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and even more strongly in the Christian tradition, is a God who cashes out in the real world. Mm-hmm. He makes covenants with peoples and etches things onto tablets, and he causes plagues that are physical plagues to free his people and lead them to a literal physical land. And he asked them to not formulate, a systematic syllogistic philosophy, but to build a tabernacle that he can live, meet them in. And with Christ, you get the incarnation, which is like the ultimate expression of that.
Ultimate tabernacle.
The ultimate tabernacle. And you get the sacraments and sacramental theology and sacramental, all that stuff. God cashes out in some way.
Yes.
So the whole arch is supposed to be a metaphysic cashing out in ethics that cashes out in politics, and they all hold together and they all harmonize with each other.
I agree.
And one mistake, terrible mistake, is the materialist mistake, right? Which is to just say all that metaphysical nonsense is just garbage, because it keeps us from doing something. We need to be ethical, dadgummit, so let's go be ethical. So just forget the keystone. If all the stones collapse, who cares? We got the most important ones, which are the biggest ones, and the heaviest ones who are touching the earth. That's one mistake. The other one is a kind of abstractionism, rationalism, heady whatever, that says, no, what matters is getting this thing at the top in the center absolutely pristinely correct, and we kind of guard it and cover it with all sorts of things. It reminds me of, this may not be a perfect analogy, but it reminds me again of Chesterton. Who, that guy just had so
amazing
much to say.
Amazing fisherman. He'd be such a tremendous fisherman to be so wise.
I know.
Wait a minute, that's not the same guy.
He wrote an essay where he basically summarized all of Western history in like three pages with three different images. And the first image was like classical Greco-Roman stuff where they were trying to create something that would be a monument to what they thought was the highest. How can we create this monument to the highest? And so the first group of people took it was a jewel, like this perfectly pristine jewel. And they created a fountain that would jettison the jewel way up high and hold it. So there's this clear crystal thing and it would be surrounded by, these beautiful wall of flowers. It's like the most beautiful, untouchable, pristine thing, don't touch it, whatever. That's the first. That's the Greco-Roman sort of view.
Okay.
But then this another civilization came along later. Like he said, pirates came and kind of destroyed everything and everything was a mess. And then the people who were left came together and tried to rebuild. And what they decided to rebuild is, I think the best honor we can give to the highest is all the stuff of existence that's actually there. So let's make a monument to the highest that's made out of, let's build a building that's got animals carved into it and trees. Mm-hmm. And, let's all put it together to look like a garden and like a zoo all in one big. So they make this giant stone building that's got people carved into it and animals carved into it and all this stuff, right? And it's all the stuff of the earth, but it's organized towards praise to the highest thing.
Gotcha.
And then the third group of people come along, and they're a group of people who are the descendants of the second group of people, and they kind of forgot what the highest thing was, and so they saw this giant building made of all these individual things, and they were like, well, those individual things are really cool, so they smashed apart the building so all the individual pieces are just spread on the ground, and they just take the individual things that they like.
Yeah.
But they don't remember what they're all organized around.
Right. Good analogy.
And it's the same sort of idea. There's these two opposite yet equal errors. The one of the first group where you treat the highest as some sort of pristine, ethereal, untouchable thing. And then the error of the other group that forgets there's a highest at all. And it therefore can't even build any sort of harmonious thing. It's like putting those two things together is what matters. And so it's like we have to keep our metaphysics true, and it has to be something that cashes out in real life.
Right.
And that's the real catch. I think that's the catch, is like we know that screaming at people is wrong, not because we have this perfect metaphysical theology, but because our metaphysical theology cashes out in a different way than screaming in people, than strangers' faces.
Yeah,
I need a drink of water.
I think Aristotle certainly was on to something To connect those things together. And I think our day probably leaves the whole metaphysical aspect of it out. And the result is that we have that kind of rubble, the third of your analogy there. But that's the point, really, because when you reestablish a connection with the transcendent, people think, well, then you're just dealing with the keystone. But the transcendent has within it the definitions for ethics and for politics. Mm-hmm. So that's where the source is for the direction that we should go when we think about ethics and politics. And so while Aristotle was right in the sense that he knew there was a category there, I think Augustine is actually a better model for us, because Augustine had the benefit of revelation, Christian revelation, and as such could look at the details of the world and not only see how they fit together amongst themselves in this world, but see how you can see through those details to the transcendent God that made them, right? Mm-hmm. So in a sense, Aristotle was right to think of the relationships ethically this way and even politically from a metaphysical position. But the details tell us that we can look symbolically at the particulars of the world, the particulars that Aristotle drew so much from, and we can connect it up with the revelation that we've been given by God and come up with a kind of symbolic relationship, what did you say a minute ago? Sacramental relationship that gives life and luster and joy and insight to people as they deal with even the most mundane things in politics. In politics being mundane, I think. So we've come up with three good reasons, it seems to me, why it's not good to shout at your political opponents, just scream at them. One would be that they're made in the image of God and deserve more dignity. A second would be that it isn't very practical. It doesn't really work. Few people are having their opinions changed because someone is in their face calling them horrible names.
Yeah.
In fact, you might argue, and some people do, that Hillary Clinton lost the election in 2016 precisely because she called everybody a basket of deplorables.
Right.
So it was calling them names that actually maybe got their ire, their backs up, right, you know, to vote against her. Who knows?
Cost her enough
of the voting public. So that maybe doesn't work. Then there's the third way that is the. The theologic, not only are we made in the image of God, but that God actually calls us to deal with our enemies in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, our enemies, it seemed like the normal thing to do is if you find somebody that's your enemy, you oppose him and you try and destroy him. And I think that's how once you have politics as the largest thing in your life, then a political opponent is as much a threat as an invading army, basically, or somebody breaking into your house. You've got to stop him from doing damage to your family or yourself.
Right.
So, or the rest of the population. You might even think I'm protecting the rest of the population from this evil, you see. And that leads you to even violence, like the fellow that tried to kill the congressman. What was his name?
Scalise,
yeah. If I shoot these guys, it will be a good thing. Mm-hmm. Or, again, to be honest, there have been abortion clinic doctors who've been shot at, maybe even killed, I forget, mm-hmm. But certainly shot at by, in a sense, well-meaning rightists,
yeah,
saying the abortions are such a horrible thing, I've got to stop them, I'm gonna take a shot at this guy to try and stop him from doing this evil. In both cases, it's the same problem, and that is that God actually tells us to do more than just do his will. He tells us to do his will in his way. And so the way matters. And how does he tell us to treat our enemies? Well, it turns out he tells us to love our enemies.
Yeah.
To pray for those who persecute us.
Right.
In the midst of their persecution, mind you.
Right.
Right? Like when Jesus says, forgive them for nailing me to this piece of wood, because they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. You can't even argue that that's an interesting little New Testament addition to things. That is the Bible.
That's it.
I mean, you could find in Proverbs, give a cup of cold water to your enemy.
Right.
Right? This notion of treating your enemy as you would a family member, or treating them with hospitality, treating them like they were, which in a larger sense means treating them like they were God, you know, like in mm-hmm. some way, like you're treating them. Mm-hmm. You never know who you're entertaining in the moment. Then we brought this up before under the auspice of, you know, we find that the radicals are not radical enough.
Exactly.
And it's always this on both sides, they're not radical enough. And I will never understand, especially people who are radical and claim themselves to be Christian, I will never understand how they can think that destroying their enemy is considered Christian.
Right.
Or destroying the enemy is considered Christian. If there really is some individual out there who's a shill for the patriarchy, then Jesus' call is for you to do some equivalent of washing their feet.
Yes. That's right.
You know, or something. Or
that's right.
Or like they strike you, you offer their other cheek, or they take your cloak, you offer them your tunic or whatever. You know, it's not radical enough to simply say, it's not radical enough. It's mundanely human to say, I will destroy my enemies. Okay. Right. As cool as Conan the Barbarian tried to make it sound and Arnold Schwarzenegger's voice about, you know, the slaughter of your enemies and hear the lamentations of their women and stuff like that. That's just human history.
That's
where everyone has fallen everywhere for thousands and thousands and thousands of years of human history. And God reveals this way of give a cup of cold water to your enemies, mm-hmm. or love your enemies, bless those who curse you, and who pray for those who spitefully use you,
yes.
and all that. To a Jewish audience that was in many ways, shape, and form wildly angrily political. Okay, not long.
Oh my
after,
goodness!
You know, not long after Jesus died. Groups of zealots and militia members like rebelled against Rome and tried to lead a rebellion to fight them. They got crushed, right? Right. There was a violent, and it caused the destruction of the temple.
Yeah, that's
right. In 70 AD. And it was talking to a group that was expecting the Messiah to be a violent political leader.
Right.
You know, who would be a king who would overthrow all his adversaries. And yet it was a king who was going to overthrow their adversaries. But it was the dominion of sin that was being overthrown.
And that's a perfect example of how it is I'm saying that we've allowed the political sphere to get so large. It's not a recent phenomenon. It's a human phenomenon to think that the political sphere is the most important. And the people who saw Jesus come and claim to be Messiah, they expected him to rise up and start an army and overthrow the Romans. Because the political sphere is life, is reality. It's the whole of life, see?
Right.
And when he actually didn't do that, they were disappointed.
Yeah.
Well, what he did was overthrow the real enemy by doing this. And they had very little insight about who the real enemy was. But it was because Jesus had a picture of the far larger sphere of life that is the spiritual one.
Right.
That, and I'm hesitant to talk this way only because I'm afraid people will think I'm pitting the two against each other. That is, there's the physical world and there's the spiritual world.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that they're like the spiritual world is a circle that's, you know, 3 feet across in diameter, and the political world is a tiny, you know, fifth of that or something,
right.
You know, but it's within that larger circle that the political is acted out. It's just that you have to see the whole picture and not simply one or the other. If you do as the Enlightenment thinkers might and separate the spiritual from the physical, then the physical actually almost has no connection to the spiritual and can't be informed by it any longer, mm-hmm. except on a kind of very subjective, personalized, relativized level. And so it's understandable why it gets dismissed. But to do that is actually just what the devil wants, for us to never actually see how the political world fits in to the larger sort of economy of God.
Right. He doesn't want us to see truth. He doesn't want to see reality.
That's right.
Right. The Greek word in the New Testament, one of the regular Greek words for truth is aletheia, which with the alpha on the front of it usually means a negation. It doesn't mean negation. It means to something was, it's similar almost to like apocalypse. You know, it's like the idea of an uncovering.
Mm-hmm.
Aletheia
mm-hmm.
is like something had like a veil or something over it, but it's been removed so you can see what's behind it.
So you see the truth.
So you can see the truth. It's like it's seeing reality. It's like
right.
There's not a filter or an illusion in front of you. There's reality.
Right.
And
right.
Jesus called the devil the father of lies, right? It's like the one who just is all about deception and twisting and manipulation and illusion and turning you away and is like an expert at it. And anything that can create disharmony on the deepest levels that can ripple out into the most practical levels, he's going to do. And it's like you said, Jesus came to overthrow the real enemies, which is sin, death, and the devil.
Right.
Right. Those were the real enemies at the back of everything that also cashed out in very real ways. And he was, as someone at Sunday night mentioned, he was one of the reasons he was crucified, you know, on the practical plane, where he was crucified, he just wasn't political enough.
Mm-hmm.
People, you know, the Pharisees had their own sort of insider reasons for wanting to get rid of them. But why did all the people get mad? Well, because he wasn't who he said he was going to be.
Right.
He wasn't the military Messiah who was going to do all this amazing thing. He's just a nobody. He's another one of many messiahs that came along and just proved to be nothing and got killed. Oh, well. You know, there's nothing. They backed the wrong horse.
Yeah.
So, you know, who cares? And yet, he overthrew the thing that actually matters. And so, it's not about the material over the physical. It's not over the spiritual. It's not about the spiritual over the material. It's putting them back together in their right relation. And just as a horrid rationalism and abstractionism is a disharmony, you know, it's a disjointing of those things.
Right.
So is a radical materialism is also a disjointing of those things. Just focusing wholly on metaphysics or focusing wholly on ethics and politics without conjoining the two are both errors.
Mm-hmm.
Both errors. Because metaphysics without ethics or politics has no cashing out and is thus completely useless. But ethics and politics without metaphysics has no grounds.
Right.
It has no center and it can only splinter and fall apart and really become the thing we think we're seeing and we're kind of afraid that we're seeing, that everybody is just becoming more and more tribalistic. Instead of sort of a unified vision of what's good, it's just little groups of like who thinks what's right and what's wrong.
Right. Reminds me of somebody called Chesterton who gave a little paragraph about a lamppost, maybe you'll recall.
Yes.
I love that he talks about how these people got together and were trying to decide whether they should take down this lamppost or not. And everybody wanted to do it, but they thought, well, first we better ask somebody who has wisdom. So they call on this monk to come in. And the monk says, well, before we do anything, the first thing we have to consider is the nature of light. And all of them, somewhat understandably, just push him out of the way and say, let's just take the lamp. They just all get together, they pull the lamppost down, and they start congratulating themselves on how efficient they were.
Right.
But then they find out that each of them had a different reason for wanting to take the lamppost down. One of them wanted to put up a different kind of lamppost. One of them didn't like the shape of it. Another one didn't like the fact that it was gas and wanted it to be electric. Another one said, I don't want any lampposts at all because I want to live in the dark because
right.
my thoughts are evil. I want right. to be able to do bad things. And they come to blows with each other, actually, over the debate of this thing. And what they come to realize is that they really should have listened to the monk, that the question about what light actually is and what good it is the first question to ask. But now what they could have debated in the light, they have to debate in the dark, because they actually lost the thing that they were aiming for. So, but the point he's making is really good, and it's the point I'm trying to make now here too, and that is that I can't separate the theoretical, you know, sort of ivory tower, distant, amorphous kind of theorizing about life from the practical aspect of day-to-day right. living. You can't separate those two from each other. If you do that, you're eternally going to fight. You're going to fight forever, because whatever you do practically is going to be done in the dark, and whatever you do only theoretically is going to have no bearing on life. It's got, the gears have been separated from each other so they don't turn, one turning the other. The point is that the theoretical actually has to be clarified so that we can know what to do on the practical level,
right.
how to put things into place. Without it, you can't live. So you can't just have the practical without the theoretical. But neither can you start a whole ivory tower kind of world that never engages with the practical. Because after all, the requirement that God gave us before the fall was to be fruitful and multiply, to tend and keep the garden, to name the animals. We got work to do. We have things to do. And they're very practical things. What is that? It's a giraffe. No, it can't be a giraffe. It has to be a Zizzy Vivitz. No, it's a giraffe. It's a giraffe. Okay, we're going to, let me get the book. I'm going to write down giraffe for that long necked thing. So, you know, we're going to move on to the antelope and the cockroach. So, but it was, I mean, we're still naming things. We're still naming stars. We're still naming amoebas, not amoebas, bacteria. We're still naming diseases. We're still naming things all the time. And the reason is because that's what we're supposed to do. It's our job to categorize, to organize, to make sense of, to flesh out the understanding of the world that God has made. But beyond that, we're supposed to be tending and keeping the garden. We're actually supposed to be bringing it to fruition and protecting it from damage and so on. So there's a day-to-day, well, fruit that has to be born from the work that we do that keeps us, sustains us, right? It makes us food to eat and so on. A house to live in. And we're supposed to be fruitful and multiply. And to do that, you have to be alive. So you have to be able to eat. And so there's practical, the work of God for man is practical in its essence. It's practical. It's day-to-day stuff. And that means that all the jobs that we're doing, for example, are worthy jobs. We're supposed to be doing plumbing work. We're supposed to be doing, you know, learning how to fly. We're supposed to be writing more efficient spreadsheets or running for Congress or whatever the job. It doesn't have to be just preaching the gospel. It's applying the gospel to everyday life that's the calling of the children of God. So we can dare not be only theoretical. We dare not be only rational about it and not practical. If this, we've got to reconnect those two things together in everybody's minds.
Well, shall we move on to recommendations?
Sure.
Wrap up?
Sure. You want to go first?
Yeah. So, so Ben Shapiro's podcast has done something called the Sunday Special, where every Sunday he has an episode where he just talks to somebody.
Yes.
And this is because of the intellectual dark web popularizing sort of an interview long form discussion. So he wants to do part of that too. And they've been fun, but the recent one this past Sunday, it's Sunday Special episode 24, had Andrew Klavan on it.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And I'm going to be honest, I was mildly curious to watch it. Klavan's podcast held my attention for a little bit, and then it just wasn't my thing.
Mm.
If you enjoy Klavan's podcast, good. But for me, it just wasn't my cup of tea for some reason.
Mm.
So I was like, well, we'll just see what's going on. I listened to it. And there was this just he's a novelist and he's also a thinker about things, and the discussion between him and Shapiro is a Jewish conservative thinker and a Christian conservative thinker talking about the West and about the imagination and about the nature of the Enlightenment and like in the nature of the good and all kinds of stuff. It was a much more surprisingly thoroughly enjoyable thing than I thought it was going to be.
I haven't heard that. I'd like to listen.
So I'm going to recommend that. It's the Sunday. It's on the Ben Shapiro's podcast. And I stress, whether you like these guys or not, or even know who they are, you should go listen. Because especially if you don't like them, you need to go listen.
Yeah, that's
because a good you
point.
Need to go listen to the people whom you don't like or disagree. You need to hear from the horse's mouth what's going on. You may be surprised, and it may help your own thinking.
Right.
Even if you still disagree with them, it may still help your disagreements. So it's Ben Shapiro's podcast, The Ben Shapiro Show. It's his Sunday Special, episode 24. It's with a guy named Andrew Klavan. So that's what I recommend.
Very good. Very good. Well, I want to recommend something, a book by a fellow called Anthony Esselin. Now, you'll know Anthony Esselin because he's the fellow that wrote the translation of the Divine Comedy that we read here at the Center, we think so highly of. He's an English professor and a Christian guy, and brilliant, brilliant mind. And he's written a book called 10 Ways to Destroy the Imagination of a Child. And I think it's very interesting indeed. It's a sort of anecdotal book. It's a very easy book to read that way. It talks about his own childhood and things that he did as a kid that he thinks really encouraged and expanded his imagination. So he's obviously against those 10 things that you can do. Right. But he talks about how it is that our culture actually does have this effect of destroying the ability of our young people to grow an imagination. And as we've talked here actually at the center for many years, the imagination is actually a gift from God that is used for not so much imagining things that don't exist, which is can be done and has to be done with some care when it's interpreting the Bible, for example, but more for seeing connections between things that do exist that you hadn't seen before. So metaphorical connections, and metaphorical connections are the only way that we get to see God. So to be able to erase or eradicate the imagination in a child would be a great way to break his relationship with God as he grows. So I think it's a very good book, ought to be read by everybody, not just those who have children, but it's about the importance of the imagination and how you can destroy it in a child.
That's all the time we have for today. You've been listening to From the Center, and we will see you next time.
See you next time.